News Extra, April 2021. Hello, my name is Steve, and welcome once again to the St. Albans and District Talking Newspaper, serving St. Albans, Harpenden, and surrounding villages. This is the News Extra edition for the week ending Saturday, the 1st of May, 2021. And so, although this is officially our April programme, you'll be listening to it in May. Before we start the programme, I'd like to warn you about a telephone scam that is currently circulating. It comes as a voice saying it is from Her Majesty's Revenue and Customs, threatening arrest unless money is paid, which can sound very frightening. However, this is a hoax. HMRC will never phone up to demand payments or threaten arrest. If you receive such a call, please just hang up immediately. On a lighter note, I just want to tell you that for the next two programmes, in May and June, I will be producing Red Saturn, and Bill has kindly stepped in and will produce News Extra. This is because of some commitments I have at the end of both those 2 months. So, very many thanks to Bill for helping me out like this. But now, on with this programme. And this time we'll have our usual roundup of news stories from the Hearts Advertiser and St Albans Review. We'll also have our selection of good bits of national radio coming up in the next week, which, as usual, will be read by John. Then we'll have a short announcement about the reopening of Hertfordshire's libraries. After that, with Election Day happening in the coming week, we have an article about voting options for people with visual impairments. After that, we have an interview. Rob Pearman talks to Helen Barnett from the Trestle Theatre Company. Following that, we have a piece from TNS Soundings about May Day. And finally, we have this week's birthdays and events this week in past years. The music in this programme is called The Curlew and is by Goffby. So now the news, and our readers today are Leslie, Angela, Wendy and Pat.
Hello, my name is Leslie, and my first article this week is one of four from the main political parties regarding next week's local elections. And its title is COVID Recovery is Key Priority for Conservatives. Conservative-led Hertfordshire has attracted widespread recognition for its groundbreaking work addressing COVID, shielding residents, mobilising volunteers, testing, local contact tracing and vaccination uptake. Driving COVID recovery is now our key priority. We will support people, particularly young adults, back into work, make government support available to local businesses, bring our high streets back to life, working closely with local retailers and hospitality businesses. Tackle the health impacts of COVID, addressing health inequalities and mental health issues. Conservatives understand the importance of a sustainable, green environment, and any Conservative-led council will be carbon neutral by 2030. If we lead at county and district, we will put £22 million into climate change projects and £10 million into flood reduction. Ensure no waste is sent to landfill by 2030. Increase tree planting in the district, planting 20,500 countywide in 2020. Spend £7 million to roll out 20-mile-an-hour zones, improve bus services, and invest £9 million in new and improved walking and cycling routes. Reverse the hated green bin charge, giving every home £45, reducing potential fly tipping and ensuring that the district continues to be a top 10 recycling council. Conservatives will invest in children, families, and our most vulnerable residents. At county level, we will invest £53 million in additional special needs school places. Invest in 10,500 new school places in the county, ensuring that children in St Albans, Harpenden and the villages continue to go to outstanding schools. Provide significant additional funding for adult social care, pledging to work in effective partnership with the NHS. Reverse the decisions of the Liberal Democrat-run District Council and provide funds and certainty to vital local charities. 1. Drive COVID recovery. 2. Deliver a sustainable future. 3. Help us all to stay healthy. 4. Support children and the vulnerable. 5. Secure the infrastructure we need. 6. Share in growth and prosperity. 1. Stop unfair green bin charges. 2. Make the district greener and more sustainable. 3. Stop risky property speculation. 4. Help our high streets and local businesses to thrive. 5. Get council services working properly. 6. Support a speedy vaccine rollout.
Hello, I'm Angela. And you probably know that election week is coming up. So my first article concerns the Liberal Democrat Party, and it's headed Liberal Democrats. Lib Dems have a vision for change. It's clear that people are tired of the vitriol and abuse, the false stories about cuts that were never made or pledges that the authors know full well can never conceivably be afforded. Liberal Democrats prefer to offer a positive vision for this district. We are committed to combating the climate emergency with real actions like tree planting, rewilding, electric vehicle facilities and so much more. Plus a new local development plan which puts climate first. We want to see more genuinely affordable housing because without it the district slides into being a place our children can't afford to live in and where so much of our workforce has to commute in by train or by car. We want to move away from grand prestige projects concentrated in the major population centres towards investing in community facilities like the Marlborough Pavilion and the Fleetville Community Centre. And we want to continue working with local businesses, which has suffered so much during the darkest days of the pandemic. People also want to be assured that we're bringing in sound financial management so that the council's projects don't massively overrun because of suspect assumptions and corner cutting, and key services don't get through their hard-earned cash like water being poured into a sieve. Unusually this year, there are county council elections on the same day as the district elections. While the county council has done well as the public health authority, there are still major questions to be answered about the number of people who died in our care homes during the pandemic. The county council needs to make sure that free school meals are provided in the holidays as well as term time. And it needs to embrace the climate agenda with more enthusiasm, especially by accepting 20 miles per hour as the norm in residential areas. It also must become much more democratic and less remote from local people and communities, as well as deliver a much more responsive road and pavement repair system. The Liberal Democrats have a vision for change at both councils. Please support us on 6th of May.
Hello, this is Wendy, and my first story is Labour pledges no one will get left behind or ignored. Even without coronavirus, this set of elections would have been challenging enough. 10 years of Tory austerity, five of which were ushered in by the Liberal Democrats in coalition, have wreaked havoc on our public services. Local authority finances are under massive pressure. Remember the loss of Nascot Lawn Respite Centre, removing vital support from some of our neediest families? As ever, cutbacks hit the poorest in our society hardest. With coronavirus, the pressures are even greater on our hard-working NHS and care services, whose reward is a £3.50 a week pay rise. and on all those providing us with essential services over the past year. Our shop workers, refuse collectors, postal workers, our public transport and taxi drivers. Nationally, Labour is committed to securing our economy, protecting the NHS and rebuilding our country. We promise that no one gets left behind or ignored. So, nationally, it was Labour who brought the motion to defend the £20 uplift to Universal Credit and pushed for free school meals being reinstated for needy families over the holidays. Locally, our commitment remains the same, ensuring we build a vibrant, inclusive, forward-looking city and district. We are committed to driving the climate change agenda through practical, achievable measures. Our councillors have backed 20 MPH zones since 2005. In 2019, we secured council support for a car-free day to include improved, more accessible public transport. Labour will press for better housing at genuinely affordable rents, the homes we need in the places we want. And backed by schools, roads and facilities to create truly sustainable communities, not car-dependent outliers. The failure of Tory and Lib Dem administrations to update the St Albans local plan in 27 years is a lamentable indictment. This city and district deserves better. Labour will promote more local employment, for example, via start-up hubs with diversified leisure uses to sustain our retail centres. To read our full manifesto commitments, visit www.stalbanslabour.org.uk. Thursday, May the 6th is the opportunity to use your voice to call for better from your district and county council. A vote for Labour will make that change happen.
Hello, my name's Pat. Greens fighting for 30 seats. St Albans District Greens are fielding their biggest ever list of candidates for 30 seats on the district and county councils in every available ward and division in the district. Buoyed by national opinion polls that put the Greens ahead of the Lib Dems and a surge of interest in environmental issues, including the climate crisis, local Greens are working hard to target a number of seats. They hope to get Green Councillor Simon Grover re-elected and build on that with other wins. As there are two council elections on the same day this year, local Greens are reporting residents telling them that they feel happy to use at least one of their votes to vote Green, even if they use the other for another party. Councillor Grover said, "We're looking at a huge surge in Green votes this year, as so many people are prepared to split their two votes between us and another party, as well as the many people who are using both of their votes for us." Lots of local issues are natural territory for the Greens, from traffic congestion and air pollution to demand for electric charging points, the state of parks, and the growing interest in tree preservation. Greens argue that measures to tackle the climate crisis can also save taxpayers' money. Green Councillor Simon Grover points to his success in getting hundreds of solar panels fitted to leisure centres. Insulation installed in leaky council buildings and special glazing for the new museum. Such measures reduce overall carbon emissions and reduce energy bills too. Simon added, "Residents are really keen to have green voices on the council, bringing in fresh thinking, saving money, and holding the administration to account on its environmental policies." Green councillors across the country, there are 370 of them, are also proud to say they are not whipped like other parties, they are not told by the party what to say or how to vote, but are free to act individually according to their conscience.
My second article is Charter Market Rebellion Over Contracts and Gazebos. Charter market traders are saying enough is enough over what they believe is a strategy to undermine the 1,200-year-old institution. St Albans stallholders have finally spoken out following months of silence after being told to sign a 27-page contract requiring them to switch to self-erected gazebos instead of the traditional market stalls. A coalition of long-term traders has blown the whistle on what they perceive as a move to grind them down and boost rival markets in the city centre. They are furious that the characteristic market stalls are set to be replaced with gazebos and claim many well-established traders have been undermined by casuals with no loyalty to St Albans. The gazebos are set to be piloted during mild summer weather, but many traders will have to pay for help in transporting and erecting them while pitch fees remain the same. In the agenda of an SADC cabinet meeting held on March the 18th, it was claimed there was overwhelming support for the gazebos from traders in a consultation meeting held prior to the pandemic. The report read, "Apparently, 75%, 60 of the 80 permanent traders attended the meeting. Among other things, a move to gazebos was suggested to save costs and return the market to break even. A show of hands showed an overall response supportive of a gazebo market, contingent upon this not resulting in an increase in fees and ideally a fee reduction." Antiques dealer Alice Young, speaking on behalf of stallholders, said, "The gazebos were never voted for by traders, but we were told there was a show of hands in support of them following a meeting in February 2020. Where are the minutes of this meeting? No vote on gazebos even happened." If people had been told there and then that there would be no stalls, there would have been outrage, but nobody thought this would happen. "We were told to use the government funds, which were meant to help us with our loss of income from the first lockdown, to buy gazebos, which we then had to erect, dismantle, transport and store. Many permanent or casual traders did not have cars big enough, nor the strength for this labour-intensive activity." The council blamed COVID for getting rid of the stall erectors and claimed the market is losing money. Even though there were queues of traders wanting pitches after the first lockdown. "This is about saving the charter market, and we feel due process has not been followed in making these changes. The measures have prompted criticism from the chief executive of the NMTF, National Market Traders Federation, after it was contacted by members trading in St Albans. Joe Harrison told SADC, "The NMTF has serious concerns as to the proposed changes being workable and adhered to by the traders, and we strongly support them in their concerns. The overriding concern by both the NMTF and the traders is that all these changes are being proposed during what has to be and has come to be known as the worst and most difficult time in living memory for both the market as a whole and the individual traders." Councillor Mandy McNeill, portfolio holder for Business, Tourism and Culture, said the council had made discretionary grants available to traders to help them through these tough times, was promoting the market through TV advertising, and now had a waiting list of over 100 traders. She told Mr. Harrison, "There is plenty of misinformation being spread, which has caused great distress to some of our traders. For example, rumours that we were going to close the market, that we intend on getting rid of traders and replacing them. Nothing could be further from the truth." Conservative group leader Councillor Mary Maynard told Mr. Harrison that Tory councillors were totally committed to the charter market and see it as much more than just a commercial enterprise. She suggested other city centre markets were being favoured financially and put in competition with the charter market. "We also think the new terms and conditions that are being proposed for traders are unnecessarily draconian and possibly illegal. They would certainly be very difficult to legally enforce. We do not agree with the way the traders have been treated by the council. There needs to be respect, and both sides need to listen to the other's concerns and issues and seek to develop a mutually agreeable approach."
Backlash over housing plans for wildlife site. Plans to infill a wildlife haven with housing have met with a furious backlash from local residents. A proposal for 6 3-bedroom homes has been submitted for 2,260 square metres of land to the rear of Oakwood Road and Hornbeams in Brickett Wood by Edit Residential Limited of St Albans. Brickett Wood Residents Association has asked for the application to be refused, claiming the site has a chequered history, including previous planning refusals and the illegal removal of trees which have not been replaced. The association says the loss of trees has made a naturally wet area prone to flooding, including neighbouring gardens, and has also affected wildlife. Commenting on the plans, BWRA said, "The application is over development of the space with a limited width access road and insufficient parking and no pedestrian access path. Vehicles exiting the proposed development pull out onto a busy road with many blind spots caused by parked cars, and with limited parking on site, visitors could make this situation worse. These proposed new houses will have a detrimental effect on many surrounding properties, including light and sound pollution." Brickett Wood has recently had a large influx of new residents from two large developments, without any increase in doctors' surgery capacity or school places, and 6 more homes would just add to the pressure on village resources. Ashridge Drive resident Russell Cray said, "On a previous rejected planning application for the same area, it was noted that a number of tree protection orders had either been removed without consent or were illegally damaged or diseased. These had to be replanted within the area of the proposed development to maintain as a wooded area and would also be classed as TPOs. However, there seems to be no reference to these replanted trees, so I can only assume these trees were never planted. I strongly object to people deliberately destroying trees with TPOs and then gaining a benefit." Carol Hardy, who lives in Ashridge Drive, said, "This entire site was heavily wooded with trees that were covered by a TPO. A considerable number of those trees were illegally felled over a bank holiday weekend. Apart from the loss of the canopy, this has led to flooding in surrounding gardens."
BLM condemns Facebook group for post selling racist figurines. Local Facebook sales groups are urged to be more vigilant after a row broke out over the trade of racist material. Hundreds of complaints were posted after a collection of figurines depicting black racial stereotypes were put up for sale on one of the St Albans pages, Items for Sale in St Albans. Nalima Patwardam said, "I alerted this disgusting post to the St Albans for BLM Facebook group, and I've also made a personal plea to my local friends to leave the group. The comments from the racists on the post were truly horrid." A spokesperson for St Albans for BLM said, "Writer Hannah Poole said, 'Unless you have been spat at, kicked, or had eggs thrown at you, all while being called that hateful term, it is unlikely you will ever understand why a small door causes such a big fuss. Racism bleeds into things that may seem innocent, but these dolls aren't innocent. They're a caricature of a caricature, based on black-faced minstrels, embodying nasty stereotypes used to degrade black people. Meanwhile, businesses profited from the design. They're a painful reminder of degradation and injustice, steeped in brutal history. You can't tell people to get over that pain, or justify still selling them as cute figurines, because it was different then. That this was on a local site with people from our community is particularly hurtful. There is growing awareness of why such things are wrong and lots of resources available to anyone who wants to understand how to do better." Ed Bailey, Labour candidate for St Peter's Ward, also raised concerns about the sale. "It's totally unacceptable that dolls based on crude and offensive caricatures of black people are being displayed and offered for sale by a St Albans-based Facebook group. The posting has already caused considerable upset and distress to many. The racist origins of these items are a matter of historical fact, and it's depressing that it still needs explaining why they should not be displayed or sold. Similar dolls were recently removed from sale from the St Albans Vintage Market, and, like eBay has done, this group should refuse to trade in the sale of items promoting racial intolerance. The Facebook group's admin has been contacted for comment.
This next piece is headed, Soundage Residents, Don't Forget to Make Your Voice Heard. Residents of Soundage Parish, which covers Jersey Farm and parts of Marshalswick as well as Soundage Village, will be able to vote on a neighbourhood plan for the parish on May the 6th. Homeowners will have received a polling card for the referendum, along with the cards for the local elections on the same date. If approved by a simple majority, the plan will be adopted and used by St Albans District Council when they make decisions about planning applications. A neighbourhood plan sets out how a community would like to see land in their neighbourhood developed and sits alongside plans made by district and county councils. The Soundage Parish Neighbourhood Plan has been written by local residents to influence the future development of the neighbourhood. Following more than 5 years of work by a dedicated team of parish councillors and local residents, and based upon extensive surveying of residents' opinions, St Albans District Council agreed that the neighbourhood plan should proceed to referendum. The purpose of the plan is to set out a positive vision of the future needs of the parish in terms of its housing development, highways and transport, commerce, employment and health, well-being and environment. It will also create a framework for delivering a sustainable future for the benefit of all who live, work in or visit the neighbourhood. The vision of the plan is to be an inclusive, cohesive and safe community with a high quality of life which retains the distinct character of its neighbourhoods. Soundage Village, Marshalswick North and Jersey Farm. Local resident and volunteer Jim Watson, who worked on the plan, said producing this plan has taken dozens of residents from across the parish several years. This means the plan is based on what residents want for their neighbourhood, not just what the parish council thinks the parish needs.
My next item is a letter from Anne Stevenson of Bernard Street, St Albans, to the editor, entitled Neglect of Social Care to Blame. I am deeply concerned about my fellow St Albans citizens who live in Grace Muriel House, an outstanding care home of 60 years' existence. Last week they were given notice of its imminent closure due to becoming financially unviable. This is catastrophic for everyone directly involved and should also concern us all. Some of the residents are aged over 100. To face unforeseen homelessness at this age should be unthinkable, not a reality. We need to put ourselves in their shoes and imagine how they are feeling. This could happen to any of us. The immediate priority is to focus on the human rights of the residents. Their voices must be heard and their care needs central to what happens next. As a former care policy advisor for Help the Aged, I am acutely aware of the potential impact of care homes closing on residents, their families and staff, especially after the year we have endured. They need time and compassion to get through this. The St Albans Abbeyfield Society will be suffering too, having been forced to make such a dreadful decision. It appears that the practical limitations of the current building mean that its continued long-term use as a residential care home is not viable. If this is the case, then I am wondering how the capital proceeds of disposal will be used by the society to support future generations of local people. We must look at the bigger picture. This is an example of the consequences of successive governments' neglect of social care over the last 20 years. Those involved in this small exemplary home will be among many others across the nation who will suffer the same fate as we await the current government's long-delayed promised plan for the reform of the broken social care system which is behind this local disaster. The pandemic has accelerated the systemic breakdown which was already imminent before COVID-19 existed. The government may ignore social care, but we must not. I urge the people of St Albans to consider the plight of those caught up in this closure and see it as a warning to plan our own future old ages and call on those in authority to work together as best they can to provide as many options of social care as possible within the appalling constraints created by successive governments looking away from those needing care. Anne Stevenson, Bernard Street, St Albans.
Neighbours saddened by plans to chop down a 150-year-old cedar tree. A cedar tree, which has stood watching over St Albans for more than a century, is being threatened with the chop. The tree, in Cranmore Court on Avenue Road, is home to various forms of wildlife and is estimated to be about 150 years old. It's facing the axe despite having a tree preservation order and being located in the city's conservation area after the council agreed its removal. The reason cited for the application, which was submitted in July last year, was moderate structural damage to the flats, which the applicant and insurer determined should be resolved by removal of said tree. Resident Gemma Brown said she's saddened by the council's response to the tree and the devastating impact it will have on her local natural habitat. She said, "It feels very precious to me, something that we should be taking great care to look after. For about 150 years, this tree has supported life and provided homes. At this time of year, I hear the woodpeckers daily. It oxygenates our air and sequesters carbon like no man-made solution can. And if perfect utility isn't enough, it's a thing of beauty. In the breeze, we watch its many branches sway gently, gifting us moments of calm, peace and contemplation through busy days. As storms lash, its dance is a drama to behold. It soars upwards, drawing resting eyes to blue sky, moving clouds, sunsets and stars. It's the daily staging for each dawn chorus and the lively metropolis for the business of nature. It does exactly what it's meant to do, and we should let it." She said she's written to council leader, Councillor Chris White, and contacted the freeholder of the property, pointing out that the removal of the tree is a technically flawed response which will result in even more damage. Tracy Harvey, head of planning for St Albans District Council, said, "An application was received last year asking for permission to fell a protected cedar tree. This was based on evidence that the tree's roots were causing subsidence at a block of flats. A number of objections were made during the consultation period, and the applicant agreed to investigate these concerns. The applicant continued their expert examinations of the site and sent a detailed response to us. While not disputing that the tree was a local amenity, the applicant provided further technical evidence that it was the cause of damage to the building. In view of this, we gave permission for the tree to be felled on the condition that it was replaced with a more suitable tree for the location."
Fundraisers embarking on sponsored walk to 25 St Albans churches. A sponsored walk around 25 of the churches in the St Albans district is taking place instead of an annual street collection. Fundraisers will be traversing the lengths of the district from Sandridge to Chiswell Green, with the walk spanning just under 20 miles. The second week of May is traditionally when church members visit door to door to collect money for Christian aid. But for the second year in a row, this has been cancelled due to the pandemic. Hatfield Road Methodist Church member Anne Wall decided to beat the £1,100 collected last year by doing something different. She explained, "We have joined forces with our sister churches, Marlborough Road and Trinity URC, and are planning to walk around 25 of the churches in the St Albans district, which, according to my calculations and Google Maps, this is nearly 18 miles. We will be going to St Leonard's in Sandridge in the north and Greenwood URC in Chiswell Green in the south. There are six of us so far who are planning to walk the entire route, but we also have enough people who would like to walk shorter distances and so form a relay team. Our oldest participant so far is 80 years old and the youngest is just 7. In 2019, the total collected house-to-house across the city was £25,000, and although they are unlikely to get anywhere near that amount, participants are hoping to reach a figure of several thousand pounds. Anne said, "Christian Aid does wonderful work in the developing world, using its money to fund projects such as providing clean water, building schools, and equipping hospitals. It would be a great shame if St Albans was unable to support them in some way this year. Trinity URC will also be holding a book sale to raise money for Christian Aid, which will take place on May the 15th outside the front of their church in Beaconsfield Road.
This piece is Confetti Cannons released at Primary School 50th Birthday. A year of celebrations marking a primary school's milestone anniversary has taken place despite the pandemic. Praywood Primary School opened on April the 23rd, 1971, to meet the demands of the newly built Verulam estate. The school has grown over the years from a small single-entry provision to a double-entry class school with an attached nursery. The site has changed and developed with the addition of standalone single and double-storey modern classrooms and upgrades to the outdoor space. Many of the current parents and some of the staff are past pupils. Due to COVID restrictions, Praywood decided to make a different approach to its 50th anniversary. Teachers planned a week of activities focused on the 1970s and the number 50. And children and staff came to school dressed in their party clothes and enjoyed dancing on the field. The Praywood School Association donated a special badge to every child to commemorate the date, featuring a 50th birthday logo designed by pupil Aurelia in a competition run earlier this year. The school and PTA also launched a 50 kilometre for 50 years challenge, a sponsored event where the children are being encouraged to cover 50 kilometres in any way they like. Head teacher Jenny Shepherd said, "After a challenging year for pupils and staff, it has been great fun to think of ways to come together as a community and celebrate Praywood's 50 years. We hope to be able to hold some special assemblies and invite past pupils and staff to visit later in the year, and maybe even to plan a PWSA ball." The school would love to hear from anyone associated with the Praywood in the past and urges them to get in touch if they would like to share photographs, reminiscences and information, or even to visit once restrictions allow.
My last article is headed "Team to Cycle Over Land and Sea in Environmental Challenge." A Coney Heath eco warrior is leading a team of endurance athletes undertaking a pioneering adventure from the Orkney Islands to the Scilly Isles to raise awareness of environmental regenerative initiatives. Isaac Kenyon, 27, will be joining four friends in cycling the length of the UK on hand-built bamboo bikes, then using water bikes to cycle across the sea and reach various islands as part of their journey. The first extended version of the traditional John O'Groats to Land's End cycle. The Pedal for Parks challenge will take them through many of the UK's national parks, green spaces and maritime environments, and the team will document innovative regeneration projects, study the degenerating impact of human tourism and urbanisation, and explore the outcomes for our physical and mental health. The journey is being filmed in support of the National Park UK Foundation and will be released as a documentary at adventure film festivals such as KMF and on Amazon Prime and COP26. The timing of the 14-day cycle also aligns with Earth Day's primary message. As the world returns to normal, we can't go back to business as usual. Isaac, who is in energy transition, said, "This is going to be a unique journey, one involving a huge magnitude of human endurance to cycle from the Orkney Islands to the Isles of Scilly. However, it is nowhere near the scale of the challenge that we are facing in regard to regenerating all of our national parks, green spaces and maritime conservation areas, which we have been interfering with for hundreds of years. Since experiencing multiple lockdowns, time outdoors in green spaces has become precious to many of us for the benefits it has for our physical and mental health. There has never been a time when we have appreciated nature as much as we do now. There may be a vaccine for COVID-19, but there is not one for climate change. At our current pace of urbanisation and human interference, The damage we are inflicting on our environment is becoming irreversible in some parts of the world. This is why making the effort now in supporting regenerative initiatives in the most protected areas of the UK, like our national parks, can make a huge difference to the future of the world around us.
And now news of a golden wedding anniversary. A former mayor and mayoress of St Albans have celebrated their golden wedding anniversary. Malcolm and Angela McMillan took advantage of the relaxation of COVID restrictions and marked their 50 happy years with a lunch in the Marquee at St Michael's Manor Hotel. Malcolm, a retired International Congress manager for the International Confederation of Midwives, served on St Albans District Council for 27 years, including 8 years on Hearts County Council and 10 years on London Colney Parish Council. He was elected mayor in 1990 to 1991 and again in 2005 to 2006. Angela was a maths teacher at Francis Bacon, now Samuel Ryder Academy, and at St Luke's in Redbourne. Malcolm has had Parkinson's for the last 7 years, with Angela acting as his main carer. He said they had been overwhelmed by 230 messages of support and congratulations, and that love, luck, and lots of laughter were the main ingredients for sustaining a lengthy relationship.
And now, the list of people whose deaths were announced in this week's edition of the Hearts Advertiser. Pamela Alvis Dean, aged 88 years. Kenneth Easy, aged 92. Anne Jones, aged 83. Travers Partridge, aged 90. Francis Swain and Beatrice Thomas, aged 101. Now, a little more of our offering from Gothby, and then we'll have our selection of interesting national radio programmes coming up this week, which, as usual, are read by John.
Now for a look at this coming week's radio highlights, and we start with Saturday, May 1st. A poignant drama about two Tyneside women drawn to London for their very different reasons. Entitled South on the Great North Road, it's at 3 o'clock on Radio 4. It's inspired by Sting's song, Heading South on the Great North Road, and includes an a cappella performance by him. Over to Radio 3 at 6:30 for Opera on 3, which features Gluck's Orfeo ed Eurydice, based on the myth of Orpheus and performed by Opera North. Then another chance to hear Rufus Hound talking to Jenny Murray, the former presenter of Woman's Hour, as she recalls her teenage years in the always very entertaining My Teenage Diary, 7:15 on Radio 4. Archive on 4 at 8 p.m. on Radio 4 looks back on the hunger strikes in the Mays prison in the 1980s, with Wednesday marking the 40th anniversary of the death of IRA member Bobby Sands. Sunday, May 2nd, The Reunion at 11 a.m. on Radio 4, and Kirsty Walk this week brings together members of the band Madness to explore a musical journey of more than 40 years. If you miss it, it's repeated on Friday, May 7th at 9 a.m. Sounds an absolute cracker. There's a two-part drama at 3 p.m. on Radio 4. Tom Stoppard's Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead, an absurdist tragicomedy about two minor characters from Shakespeare's Hamlet who are condemned to an existence in the wings with no control over their destinies. Part 2 is next Sunday. Three music programmes to consider this Sunday. Sunday night is Music Night, 7 p.m. Radio 2. And you can listen again to the 2017 live concert from the Cheltenham Jazz Festival, celebrating the story of soul. The BBC Concert Orchestra and Guy Barker Big Band and vocalists perform musical gems associated with Ray Charles, Otis Redding, Etta James, Aretha Franklin, Diana Ross, Sam Cooke, Marvin Gaye and James Brown. That would be a heck of a lineup. At 8 p.m. on Radio 3, the BBC Young Musician Final, three soloists compete to win the most prestigious prize for young classical musicians in Great Britain. And back to Radio 2 at 9, for Seb Coe, a day without jazz is like a day without running, in which to mark this weekend's online edition of the Cheltenham Jazz Festival, the former Olympic runner plays his favourite recordings. Onto those programmes then that are broadcast each day at the same time, every day, weekday, Monday to Friday. So same time, same radio station, every day, Monday to Friday. You got it. Three novels, two readings, and one dramatisation to tell you about. So Book of the Week at 9:45 each day on Radio 4 is The King's Painter, The Life and Times of Hans Holbein. Simon Russell Beale reads Franny Moyle's history of Henry VII's youngest court painter. It's repeated every night at 12:30. The 15-minute drama at 10:45 a.m. each day on Radio 4 is Hardy's Women, The Woodlanders. Dramatisation of Thomas Hardy's novel in which Marty South tells no one of her love for Giles Winterbourne. Just after midday each day, Indira Varma reads from John McGregor's new novel Lean, Fall and Stand on Radio 4. When an Antarctic research expedition goes wrong, the consequences are far-reaching for the men involved and their families. Again repeated every night at 10:45. Composer of the Week at 12 noon each day on Radio 3 is American Aaron Copland, 1900 to 1990. His most productive decade was the 1940s, during which, with his initial trip to Mexico, the composer found cultural riches that spurred him to, quote, awaken the spiritual consciences of the people in their music. And back to Radio 4 each day, 1:45 for Laws That Aren't Laws. Robin Ince looks at nebulous laws and principles that govern our lives, even when we don't believe they're true. The first programme covers Murphy's Law, which states, what ever can go wrong, will go wrong. Hopefully not at the moment. It's bank holiday weekend, so bank holiday fairings, Monday, May 3rd. There's a new series on Radio 4 at 6:30, Nature Table, in which comedian Sue Perkins is joined by Chris Packham, Michaela Strachan and Desiree Birch for a nature-themed comedy panel show recorded at London Zoo. If you miss it, it's on next Sunday. Then at 8 p.m. on Radio 4 comes Tricky, Does Your Vote Matter? It does in simple numerical terms, but what if the party you favour has no chance of getting in? Well, you can't find anyone you want to vote for. Is it then worth voting? Discuss. Finally, for Monday, May 3rd, The Prime Minister at 300. Another chance to hear historian Anthony Seldon's recent three-part series in which he considers the role of Prime Ministers going back 300 years to Robert Walpole. It's on Monday, Tuesday and Wednesday this week at 11:30 p.m. on Radio 4. Tuesday, May 4th. Life on Hold at 11:30 a.m. on Radio 4 follows five people as they navigate their way through mental health services. Among them is Jessie, a frontline worker who started experiencing anxiety while working to help those with coronavirus. And Matt, whose ongoing battle with depression became worse after losing his job at the start of the pandemic. Drama at 2:15 on Radio 4 is An Angel in Miami. Amir Hernandez runs a top Miami club, drives a purple convertible and has a beautiful business partner. But when his special celebrity guest fails to show up, the punters become restless. Radio 3 in Concert at 7:30 p.m. features three composers who reveal the power that Scotland's history, landscape and folklore have over them in a concert recorded on April 25th at the Barbican in London. Includes Davis's An Orkney Wedding with Sunrise, Beamish's Viola Concerto No. 3, Under the Wing of the Rock, and Mendelssohn's Symphony No. 3 in A. Back to Radio 4 at 8 p.m. for One Night in March. A report into the case of Anthony Granger, who, when unarmed, was shot and killed in a Greater Manchester police operation in 2012. The story is told by Anthony's partner Gail and his mother Marina. 8:40, In Touch with Peter White, as it's Tuesday. And finally for Tuesday, May 4th, Jazz Show with Jamie Cullen. And again, highlights from this year's online Cheltenham Jazz Festival. Radio 2, 9 p.m. Wednesday, May 5th, in Life Changing at 9 a.m. on Radio 4, Jane Garvey talks to people about extraordinary turning points in their lives. It's the story of Keith Williams, who was born in 1952 and brought up as the son of a coal merchant in South Wales. Then at the age of 13, he found out he'd been adopted, but it was only in his 40s that he set out to find his birth parents, a journey of self-discovery that took him to Malaysia. Drama at 2.15 on Radio 4 is Comrade, Ackland and I, fact-based drama set in 1936 in which poet Valentine Ackland and best-selling writer Sylvia Townsend Warner have their rural idyll interrupted by the sudden arrival of a young tourist involved in a car accident. Radio 3 in Concert features harpsichordist Mahan Estahani in a performance of 24 mini masterworks by Bach, The Well-Tempered Clavier Book 1, recorded in April at Wigmore Hall in London. PJ Woodhouse fans will enjoy the inimitable PJ Woodhouse at 9 p.m. on Radio 4 Extra. Alexander Armstrong celebrates the author's humorous works with his characters brought to life by Simon Cadell, Michael Horndon and Richard Briers. And a new series on Radio 4 at 11 p.m. is Jamie McDonald, Life on the Blink. Comedian Jamie found himself going blind in his teens and he reveals how he used humour to turn denial into acceptance. Thursday, May 6th, Thinking in Colour, 11:30 a.m, Radio 4, journalist Gary Young explores how racial identity upends the methods of recognising and categorising human beings by skin colour. The afternoon concert on Radio 3 at 2 p.m. features one of Massenet's most popular operas, Manon. Lescaut, a well-meaning young man, is led astray by his love for a young woman he finds irresistible. There are many other young men who also fall for her, some willing to buy her with offers of a luxurious lifestyle. Drama at 2.15 on Radio 4 is a thriller by Peter Strickland, the third consecutive event in Talbot Lee. Exhausted new parents Jen and Tim have booked a short break at a high-tech luxury home with a voice-operated smart speaker system. But the weekend doesn't quite go to plan. 3 p.m. Radio 4, a new series of Ramblings. This week, Claire Balding accompanies best-selling author and children's laureate Cressida Cowell for a nostalgic walk in West Sussex, a 6-mile route known as the Trundle Loop, which begins and ends in the village of Charlton. There is live football in the Europa League semi-finals, Roma versus Manchester United, Arsenal versus Villarreal, from 7 o'clock on Radio 5 Live. And Radio 3 at 7:30 p.m. if you'd like a little bit more peace and quiet. Radio 3 in Concert. Here, the London Philharmonic Orchestra playing hugely popular works by Beethoven, Piano Concerto No. 5 in E-flat, and Sibelius's Symphony No. 7. Friday, May 7th. Drama, 2:15, Radio 4, Running with Lions by Sian Davila. The first of three half-hour plays performed by the Tuala Theatre Company, established in 1986 to tell stories reflecting black experiences. This story tells of a family dealing with grief against a backdrop of a church that not all the family members find joyous. A new series at 3:45 on Radio 4 is Empty Stages, a series of three short stories involving around life in the theatre. Put My Names in Lights by Lolita Chakrabarty. 82-year-old Gloria Grayson is due to make her West End comeback after 20 years, but the day before the press night, the pandemic closes all the theatres. 9 p.m. on Radio 4, Meeting Myself Coming Back, in which public figures reflect on their careers. Alistair Campbell, Tony Blair's former press secretary, looks back at his time at the heart of government to his subsequent work as a mental health campaigner. And we round off this week's highlights on Friday, May 7th. Sit back, enjoy Margarita Taylor's choice of smooth classics, 10 p.m. on Classic FM. May I wish you a peaceful, safe and enjoyable week of radio listening.
Here we have a piece read by Rob about the reopening of Hertfordshire's libraries.
I've received an update from the Hearts Library Service. At last, our local libraries are able to get back to something approaching normality. Here's what they say. Hertfordshire Libraries are keen to welcome you back. Following the government's latest easing of lockdown in England on the 12th of April, many of our libraries are now open for customers to come inside and browse. Our library staff across the county have missed customers entering our buildings, and our shelves are bursting with new books waiting to be borrowed. So what can your local library provide? All our open libraries have been certified as COVID secure, so you can visit them with confidence. We're asking everyone to wear a face mask and keep visits short to help protect all of us. In order to help with this, we've reintroduced grab-and-go packs. These are pre-selected packs with titles from your favourite genre, perfect if you're looking for inspiration for what to read next. It's still possible to browse the shelves and look for your favourite author or for books about a non-fiction topic. All libraries have their collections of large print and audiobooks available. And don't forget, these are free to borrow if you have a visual impairment. You can still reserve individual titles to collect at any open library, and again, this is a free service if you have a visual impairment. Staff are always on hand to advise and help you if your library looks a little different to what you're used to. And finally, we are opening more and more of our smaller community libraries over the coming weeks. For all the latest information and the current opening hours for your local library, please visit our website, hertfordshire.gov.uk/libraries, or call the Customer Service Centre on 0300 123 4049. 0300 123 4049.
And now this is the item about voting options for visually impaired people in the coming week's elections.
Hello, this is Heather with some information about forthcoming elections in early May. There are a significant number of elections being held on Thursday, the 6th of May this year, with England, Scotland and Wales all holding some form of elections. The BBC estimates that 48 million people will be eligible to vote on the 6th of May, selecting around 5,000 politicians to represent their views. With so many elections in May 2021, this article includes a timely reminder of what to expect if you vote in person with a visual impairment. So, which elections are being held this year? Scotland will be voting for all 129 members of the Scottish Parliament, and in Wales, all 60 seats in the Senedd, the Welsh Parliament, are up for election. In England, all areas will be voting for police and crime commissioners, who set the budget and priorities for local police forces in their areas. In addition, many English areas will also be holding local elections for councillors to serve on their district, borough, unitary or county councils. In London, voters will elect the Mayor of London and 25 Greater London Authority members. They will also be voting for directly elected mayors in a further 13 large urban areas of England, for example in places including Greater Manchester, Doncaster, Bristol, the West Midlands, Cambridgeshire and Peterborough, and the Tees Valley. Local elections in England are normally phased across a four-year cycle, but there are more elections than normal this year because elections originally scheduled for last year were postponed due to COVID-19. With so many elections this year, you may have to complete a different ballot paper for each type of election depending on the number of voting opportunities where you live. After a general election in 2019, England is next expected to hold parliamentary elections in 2024. So, to vote in May's elections, you must be aged 18 or over and registered at an address in the area where you want to vote. It's worth remembering that anyone can apply for a postal vote or a proxy vote if they do not want to go to a polling station in person, but if you haven't already done this, it may be too late for this year. So, if you have a visual impairment, what happens when you get to a polling station? All voters have a right to vote independently and in secret, and the local authorities who manage the elections have to ensure that polling stations are accessible to people with sight loss. The RNIB has been active in lobbying to ensure visually impaired people can vote as easily as possible. RNIB outlines four options that may help you vote. First, by law, every polling station must display a large print copy of the ballot paper for reference. They must also provide a reference copy for you to take into the booth with you. You can use this large print copy to read all the information on the ballot form, but you must still cast your vote on a standard print ballot paper.
Secondly, each polling station must also provide the option of using a tactile device to place your vote. This device has a sticky backing which attaches on top of your ballot paper. It has numbered lift-up flaps with the numbers both raised and in braille, and these fit directly over the boxes where you mark your vote. You may need to use the large print ballot form or ask someone, a companion or polling station staff, to read out the list of candidates to you. The candidates are always in alphabetical order. If there are a lot of candidates, you may need to remember the number of the candidate you wish to vote for, then lift the flap with the same number and mark your X in the box. You can then detach the tactile device and fold your voting paper in half before posting it in the ballot box. Thirdly, if you have difficulty using both the large print paper or the tactile voting device, you can also request somebody to help you at the polling station. They can help guide you between the entrance, desk, polling booth and ballot box. They can also vote on your behalf. The person helping you could be one of the polling station staff or somebody that you bring with you. If you bring your own companion, they must be a member of your immediate family who's over 18 or someone who's legally able to vote in a UK election. Fourthly and finally, after RNIB lobbying, the government has also told election returning officers that they can allow people with sight loss to use tools such as video magnifiers or mobile phones to help them vote independently. Unfortunately, though, the final decision about whether to allow this sits with the individual returning officer in each area, so it's not possible to guarantee that this option will be available in every area. When you go to vote on the 6th of May, make sure you mention your sight loss to the person on duty in the polling station and ask them for details of the help available so that you can choose the best option to help you cast your votes.
We now have another interview about the district's theatre companies. Rob Pearman talks to Helen Barnett from the Trestle Theatre Company.
In the second of our series on the local theatre and drama scene, I chatted with Helen Barnett, Creative Director of the Trestle Theatre Company. Helen, most of us know of Trestle. We read about it in the paper. Not all of us necessarily understand quite what it is. Now, you are the Creative Director of the Trestle Theatre Company. There is a place called the Trestle Arts Base. Can you just map that out for us so we understand quite who's who and what's what?
Yes, absolutely. We were a company, a theatre company, founded in 1981 as a mask and physical theatre company. We were really fascinated in taking mask performance to everywhere, and we travelled internationally and we did a lot of touring. As the company kind of developed and grew, they realised that they really needed a base, somewhere to make this work, somewhere to work and collaborate with other organisations. And being based in the area, they saw that the chapel at Hill End Hospital was up for tender, and they applied for a large grant from the Arts Council England to renovate and to be able to apply for that building. And they were successful in 2002, and there was a big renovation and turned it into the Trestle Arts Base that we know now. Although we are a company, we still work internationally. We work nationally. We sell our masks and workshops and take our shows all over. We have been kind of rooted at this art space in St Albans since 2002, and it's been amazing working with the local community and growing our services there. We run the art space, but we also provide space for other arts organisations. So you might come along to a workshop by the dance studio at the art space as well, or you might come along to a yoga class, but we manage the building alongside the other aspects of our company.
Okay, a couple of things you said there that I want to pick up on. One, you referred to masks. Now, that might be worth explaining. Where does that come from? Why are you involved in making masks?
At the time of the company forming, they were particularly interested in theatrical masks and mime and moving picture. And that's kind of grown. I mean, we've gone through lots of different phases as a company. We did work with international residences with companies in India, Spain and Poland. And we kind of developed our physical theatre aspect as well. But we've always come back to the masks as a hook of our work of communication and storytelling. And they are just such a wonderful tool for nonverbal communication and thinking about things like, you know, particularly working with young people as we do a lot of now. The ability to distance oneself from the performer and the performance is really, really interesting. And that's what masks enables us to do. We're not always in mask and we don't only work with mask, but it's been something that has helped us to unlock the creativity of ourselves and also people that we work with across the history of the company. And we make four different mask sets from the art space. We've got two fabulous mask makers, and they are a resource that are kind of brought by schools and healthcare organizations and drama therapists and higher education establishments across the world. And it's amazing to hear how they're used in all these different ways. And we're really trying to explore the use of masks as a tool for not just in kind of drama lessons or with creatives, but also as a way of talking about, you know, emotions and communication.
You talked about your role in the local community, and you just talked there about what sounds to me like classes. Do you have groups of kids coming in or young people? Is that how it works, that people come in to understand about theatre, understand about masks, understand about performance?
At the Art Space, we run our School of Drama, which is four weekly sessions for young people aged from four all the way up to 18. They are really about unlocking a creative process, and they're very much led by the participants in terms of what they want to do, what they want to work on. We do a lot of devising and storytelling, and we do a lot of drama that is based around them and what they think. So, for example, at the moment, our groups are all working on podcasts because they're working online. So they're creating podcasts that are kind of a look back at their history and a look forward of where they want to be in 10 years' time. And it's been amazing having those conversations with young people. And that's the kind of work that we do, always using drama skills and technique and developing those in the young people as well. But it's a social opportunity and a kind of creative exploration as well for them, which is great. And we also have our three inclusive groups, Act Up, Dance Now and Sing Out, which are all run at the Art Space weekday afternoons. Therefore, anyone that wants to come in a really easy level, that's really open and just have some fun with it, really. So we cover all those three types of art, and we find those groups really, really cathartic. They're often accessed by day services as well, and for adults who have additional needs or who are finding themselves with lots of spare time and want to come and connect with other people.
So it's not about performing to an audience. Majority of what you do is about the individuals who are the groups who are in there in experiencing something. It's less about an audience facing business.
I think that's a really lovely way of looking at it, Rob. Yeah, I mean, we do make shows, we make performances, we've done projects that are shared all around St. Albans, and we've taken shows on tour with professional actors. Like, we do that. And we also have shows coming in from other companies to present at the Art Space as well. So you can come to the Art Space to see a performance. But what it is about for us is the process. And it's about using drama as a way to connect with other people, to be creative, to unlock some of those things that we might find difficult, whether we're 16 or 60, and be included in the local art scene.
There's a cafe there. Is that for anybody to wander in off the street to find out what's going on, or is it just for those who are working there?
We very much see the Art Space as a centre for everybody. It's got step-free access, and it's somewhere that we want people to feel is theirs. Yes, a dance class might be happening. Yes, a drama workshop might be happening. But if you want to come and have a tea cake, and we also have a very infamous soup from our wonderful Mary, who runs the cafe. I don't know if you've heard about this, Rob, but that's often complimented. So that's worth a try as well, I have to say.
All this sounds great. And then in the beginning of last year, the pandemic struck.
Yes.
And places like yours presumably had to close down fairly quickly.
Yes, yeah, so it was very strange for people that are constantly working with others to all go home one day and then to not come back together the next day. Was very odd. I mean, one thing I will say about Trestle is the core staff are very much a family, and some of us have been working for the company for 10 years and more. So it was very, very odd to have to close our doors. We've been there for 15 years. However, we were really, really lucky to quite quickly receive some support from the government and from the St. Albans District Council. And we were actually able to start bringing things back by the summer last year. So we weren't closed for that long. As soon as we were able to open our doors again, we did. And then by September, we were actually all back. We were running our classes in COVID secure ways. Some people were joining from online. Some people were joining from the base. It was absolutely all systems go, which was amazing. And I think a real testament to the people that we work with, the participants and the staff. It was such a great thing to be back in the space. And then November came and we had to close again. But I think this time we were very much prepared and we did quite a lot to strengthen our ability to go straight online. And we were able to take all of our classes online. We were working with schools. We were working with teachers. We were providing training. We were teaching at universities still. We were running our regular classes at the art space, everything online. So we've really had to embrace new ways of working, particularly as a company who are so focused on physicality and that kind of drama. It's been a learning curve, but I think it's actually been really interesting for us as a company. It's helped us to access new people. We've been able to keep our services running, which has been an absolute lifeline for some of our service users and some of our participants. And it's just been a joy to see how everyone has adapted with us. And now, obviously, we are hoping to reopen our doors, at least for our School of Drama, following the Easter holidays, and to slowly start bringing things back again from there. So, yeah, it's been a very difficult year, but I think we've been incredibly flexible. We've always been used to adapting and changing, and we haven't stopped now. I mean, I think big thing for me is actually how much we have still managed to achieve this year, and also how much we've been able to support other companies. You know, we've had companies come in and live stream from our space. We've had companies come in and run COVID secure training because they needed a bigger venue than where they usually go. And I think that sense of coming together and supporting each other, enabling us to all keep going, has been really, really strong. And having a venue as a company to be able to do that for other people has been wonderful as well.
So an individual can come to Trestle, and a group, if there's a group of people who are doing something, thinking this sounds like a useful resource that we might get engaged with, that you could have individuals coming to you or groups, is that right?
All of our classes are, you know, we have spaces in most of them. So you can always drop us a line and ask to get involved on admin@trestle.org.uk. And we will happily kind of steer you to the right group for you. We have a whole page on our website, which is called Creative Through COVID, which is full of resources that we created the week before we actually shut. Our School of Drama creative projects manager, who runs the School of Drama, was frantically recording all of these brilliant creative challenges for us. And we made a make your own print and make your own mask as well that our mask makers created. And there's a whole page on our website of things that you can do and get creative with. We're very much about providing stuff for people to engage. So all of that is suggestions for you to get creative. All of the other things that we do in terms of companies that we support to create shows or anything that we're streaming ourselves, that all goes up on our social media. So the best thing to do is to follow us on our social media, and then you'll keep in touch with all of it and you'll know what's going on.
Okay, let's just turn to what's coming up now, because you said that you're looking forward to getting back into work as the lockdown eases. We fingers crossed. You talked about things you've discovered. Now, COVID's been a horrendous experience for most people, let's face it. And it's been awful for some and worse for others. And some of us have coped and got through. But you can sense that people have picked out there's new ways of working. There's not just the working from home rather than going into the office every day. Other things. And you said this, I'm interested. You've been doing things with media that perhaps, or visual media that you haven't perhaps been doing before. Do you think this is really going to carry forward?
Yeah, absolutely. Some of our digital content and some of our workshops that we've run specifically for facilitators and practitioners have been attended by people from around the world. Getting across on a plane is a lot harder than joining through Zooms. It's really helped us to think about how we can still develop people to use our skills, but without being in the same space as them. And as theatre practitioners, that wasn't something that was even talked about before all of this. The space is so sacred for us, where we create together, that thinking that you could do that online on Zoom, that would have been unheard of. But now that we've got all of these tools and we've discovered all of these different ways in which we can still connect but be online, I think it's definitely going to continue for us, and it will mean that we can offer things for people that we perhaps couldn't offer before. You know, we were actually working with a school in Singapore over lockdown as well to work with our masks, which was fascinating. And I'd be really interested for us to develop that work further. We also ran a course with Mind in Mid-Hearts online that was specifically for adults who were struggling with their mental health. Now, obviously, that's going to be something that's hugely necessary after the impact of this pandemic, and something that actually doing it online relieves a lot of stress. It takes away anxiety of having to navigate that social space with other people. So that's something that we're thinking of growing and looking at as well. So yeah, there has been a lot of learning. And I think generally finding ways to communicate with each other and ensure that that's really clear has been really important, because when you're not in the same room as people, when you're not able to meet up in big meetings with your partners and other organisations, it's much harder, and you have to be a lot more specific and clear about your objectives. And I actually think that's been a really positive thing, and it's led to some really great partnerships for us over the last year that I hope will continue.
It's really interesting, isn't it? Because it's potentially transformative without losing any of what you do traditionally. You're adding opportunities for people as well down the line.
Yeah, I hope so. And just the fact that we've been able to continue doing the work that we do with our regular participants, that has been a real positive for us. And I think that will always make that learning useful and relevant, because just if we ever find ourselves in a situation again, or even, you know, with someone who can't access something, we now have tools that we can use. And I think it is going to open up access for people, for a lot of people. There's been a lot of discussion around how it's opened up the workplace for people who have different access needs as well. And I think that that's a really positive thing. It has been awful, but I think we can find some of these silver linings that mean that there's something that can come from it.
The cafe's already open. You can get a takeaway coffee from there, but you're opening up other facilities step by step now as the lockdown agenda develops stage by stage. And you're hoping, what, by the May break, if that comes through as planned, May the 17th, after that, you're pretty well able to do most of what you want?
Hopefully, yeah. We were able to bring everything back in line with the government guidance at the time back in September, and we're planning to do the same now. You know, I think everybody's wary, aren't they, that the official government guidance hasn't yet been green lighted. We haven't had the I's dotted and T's crossed, but absolutely, we are ready and we're watching. And as soon as that information comes through, we will be there and flinging those doors open. But one thing we are really focusing on as well is making sure that those opportunities are still digital as well. So we're working with the museum at the moment. We're going to be one of the first exhibitions that are back when we can open on May 17th. And we're going to be celebrating our 40th birthday this year as a company. And we're running an exhibition called Behind the Mask at St Albans Museum and Galleries. And we're also then going to take that online. So we're trying to look at ways of making it accessible for everyone if people can't travel. Yeah, I think we will be providing stuff here and also continuing with some of our online stuff as well.
What will it be like in the museum itself? An exhibition in a traditional sense, or are you going to have people there moving about all the time?
It is going to be a traditional exhibition, but there will be lots of engagement to take part in as well. So there will be workshop opportunities, there'll be talks, there'll be online and in-person ways of engaging with us as a company. But the exhibition itself is going to be charting the history of the company. There'll be an opportunity to see some of the masks from our older shows and our more recent shows. There'll be opportunity to things like in the early 2000s, we created some masks that were made for the Brit Awards, for example. So they'll be on display. It's going to be a really lovely celebration of all of the things that we've achieved. And writing it right now, I have to say, it's absolutely fascinating to look at that 40 years in detail and to go, goodness me, haven't we achieved a lot as a company? It's quite amazing. And it really does give you some drive through this year, which could be really, really hard, of going, there is purpose in all of this and we must continue to do it.
If all the schedules run as planned, that exhibition will open, I think it's on the 17th of May. Is that right? through till September.
Yeah, 17th of May through to September.
There's plenty of time for people to go there. But of course, now you've established a worldwide audience for your internet versions of your work, you will be able to spread it around the world.
Yeah, and we're really excited as well because Trestle has engaged with a lot of countries across the years. So it's really nice to actually be able to, you know, I'm interviewing someone who did a lot of our work in Holland. So it's been really great to make those connections as well. And hopefully they'll all be able to see the exhibition when it goes online, which would be great.
Well, that's fascinating, Helen. I have to admit, I didn't know there was so much in it. It's been amazing to listen, and I'm very grateful for you running that description of so many activities going on there. Thank you very much indeed for your time.
It's lovely to be able to let people know exactly what we do, and we look forward to welcoming everyone to us. And do get in touch, even if you're not sure where you might fit, but you're interested in doing something creative. We're always keen to signpost people to the right places.
Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you so much, Rob. Lovely to speak to you.
You can find out more about all the classes and opportunities if you look at the website trestle.org.uk.
And now we have an article from TNF Soundings about May Day.
TNF Soundings. Features from across the UK.
Hello, this is Tanya with a piece by Jane about May Day traditions across the country. May Day being the day which marks the beginning of summer. May Day is usually observed on the 1st of May. This year, 2021, the May Day Bank Holiday will take place on Monday the 3rd of May, with celebrations over the long weekend. Workers and school children will have a day off to celebrate the end of spring and the start of summer with their friends and family. The Feast of Floralia, or Festival of Flowers, believed to have been celebrated by the Romans, preceded May Day. But the name and the celebrations changed over the years to what we now know it to be. The 1st of May is also known as International Workers' Day, particularly in socialist and communist countries. But we're focusing here on the traditional British celebrations heralding the summer. In the UK, May Day is marked by traditional country celebrations. The main ones, such as Morris dancing, maypole dancing, and the crowning of a May Queen, still occur all over the country in villages, towns, and cities. Crowning of the May Queen is important for many, with the mayor or a local committee nominating a girl to lead a procession around the village green. Traditionally, the May Queen is dressed in white and crowned with a wreath of country flowers, and often she sits on a throne to watch the afternoon's activities. Maypole dancing takes place around a tall white pole in the centre of the green, usually with children from local schools. Each dancer holds a long, colourful ribbon which is wound crisscross around the pole as they dance to produce a pretty pattern on the pole. Again, white is traditional for clothing, with girls in white dresses and boys in white shirts. Often folk musicians play the music to accompany the dances, typically using accordions, drums, and fifes or pipes. The same musicians will also play for Morris dancers who dress in traditional white outfits with bells around their ankles to ring out the rhythms as they dance. Sticks and handkerchiefs are used in the dances, and some dancers also have hats adorned with feathers, flowers, or wheat. Others sometimes have coloured faces to represent characters in the stories told by the dancers. Dances, traditions, and costumes worn by the Morris dancers do vary across the country as regions mark May Day in different ways. Just a few examples of these are: in Whitstable in Kent, a character dressed in green is called Jack the Green. In Cambridgeshire villages, girls make May dolls, which they leave on doorsteps for occupants to find. Oxford celebrates with May madrigals, sang by the choir of Magdalen College on top of the college tower. This takes place at 6 a.m. on May morning, and usually a rowdy crowd of students who celebrated the night before can be seen listening to the tunes. It's also traditional that some students jump off the Cherwell Bridge into the River Cherwell below. But this is a dangerous act, as the river is only 61 centimetres deep in some places. However, wherever the celebrations take place, and however different they may be, especially in this year of COVID-19, the meaning behind them all remains the same. Welcome to summertime!
TNF Soundings.
Now here's our piece of music, The Curlew by Goffby in its entirety. Here are some well-known people whose birthdays fall this week. On the 2nd of May 1975, David Beckham, the former professional footballer and model, was born in Leytonstone, London. He is the first English player to win league titles in four countries: England, Spain, the United States, and France. He retired in May 2013 after a 20-year career, during which he won 19 major trophies. Beckham's professional club career began with Manchester United, when he made his first team debut in 1992 at the age of 17. He went on to have an outstanding career both here in the UK and abroad. He has been a UNICEF UK ambassador since 2005, and in 2015 he launched Seven, the David Beckham UNICEF Fund. He has been married to Victoria Beckham since 1999, and they have four children. On the 3rd of May 1958, Sandy Toksvig was born in Copenhagen, Denmark. She is a British-Danish writer, broadcaster, actor and producer on British radio, stage and television. She is also a political activist, having co-founded the Women's Equality Party in 2015. She has written plays, novels and books for children. In 1994, she came out as a lesbian. And in 2016, Toksvig took over from Stephen Fry as host of the BBC television quiz show QI, having previously spent 10 years hosting the news quiz on BBC Radio 4. In 2017, she became co-presenter of The Great British Bake Off, alongside comedian Noel Fielding. Toksvig was installed as Chancellor of the University of Portsmouth in October 2012, and is the president of the Women of the Year Lunch. She was appointed an officer of the Order of the British Empire, OBE, in the 2014 New Year's Honours for services to broadcasting. On the 4th of May 1923, Audrey Hepburn was born Audrey Kathleen Rusten in Brussels, Belgium. She was a British actress and humanitarian. Recognised as a film and fashion icon, she was ranked by the American Film Institute as the third greatest female screen legend in Golden Age Hollywood, and was inducted into the International Best Dressed List Hall of Fame. She appeared in many films, the most famous and iconic being the romantic comedy Breakfast at Tiffany's in 1961. She rarely featured in films after 1967. She remains one of only 15 people who have won Academy, Emmy, Grammy and Tony Awards. Later in life, she devoted much of her time to UNICEF, to which she had contributed since 1954. She died in January 1993. On the 5th of May 1988, the British singer Adele was born Adele Laurie Blue Adkins in Tottenham, London. She is an English singer-songwriter, and her debut album, called 19, was released in 2008 to commercial and critical success. It is certified 8 times platinum in the UK and 3 times platinum in the US. The album contains her first song, Hometown Glory, written when she was 16, which is based on her home suburb of West Norwood in London. She was the first female artist to simultaneously have 2 albums in the top 5 of the US Billboard 200 and 2 singles in the top 5 of the Billboard Hot 100, as well as the first woman in the history of the Billboard Hot 100 to have 3 simultaneous top 10 singles as a lead artist with Rolling in the Deep, Someone Like You, and Set Fire to the Rain, all of which also topped the chart. With sales of more than 120 million records, Adele is one of the world's best-selling music artists. On the 6th of May 2019, Archie Harrison Mountbatten Windsor was born in London. He is the son of Prince Harry, Duke of Sussex, and Meghan, Duchess of Sussex. A great-grandchild of the Queen, he is 7th in line of succession to the British throne. On the 7th of May 1917, David Tomlinson, the British stage, film and television actor and comedian, was born in Henley-on-Thames. Having been described as both a leading man and a character actor, he is primarily remembered for his roles as authority figure George Banks in Mary Poppins, fraudulent magician Professor Emilius Brown in Bedknobs and Broomsticks, and as hapless antagonist Peter Thorndike in The Love Bug. Tomlinson was posthumously inducted as a Disney legend in 2002. On the 8th of May 1926, David Attenborough, British broadcaster, natural historian and all-round national treasure, was born in Isleworth, West London. His career with the BBC began in the 1950s when he started making wildlife programmes. He became controller of BBC Two in 1965, a post he held until 1969. During this time, he commissioned such programmes as Call My Bluff, Match of the Day, The Old Grey Whistle Test, and Monty Python's Flying Circus. He returned to programme-making and began his run of groundbreaking wildlife documentaries with Life on Earth in 1979, since when he has risen to ever greater national affection and respect with each successive series. He does, however, hate the term national treasure. And finally, some notable events which happened this week in the past. On the 2nd of May 1997, Labour Party leader Tony Blair became Prime Minister of the United Kingdom. At the age of 43, he was the youngest person to hold the office since 1812, when Lord Liverpool became Prime Minister, aged just 1 year younger at 42. On the 3rd of May 1937, American author Margaret Mitchell won a Pulitzer Prize for her enormously popular novel Gone with the Wind, which was made into an Academy Award-winning motion picture 2 years later. It was the only novel by her published in her lifetime. On the 4th of May 2000, British politician Ken Livingstone was elected Mayor of London, the first time that British voters had directly elected a candidate to an executive office at any level of government. He remained in office until 2008, when he was defeated by Boris Johnson. In his time as mayor, he introduced the congestion charge, the Oyster card, and bendy buses. He's been described as the only truly successful left-wing politician of modern times. On the 5th of May 1961, Alan Shepard became the first US astronaut to travel in space in his Mercury capsule named Freedom 7. Freedom 7 was launched on top of a Redstone rocket, which was a converted intercontinental ballistic missile, and wasn't powerful enough to propel him into orbit. So, having attained an altitude of 116 miles, Freedom 7 splashed down in the Atlantic Ocean only 15 minutes after its launch. On the 6th of May 1994, Queen Elizabeth II and the then French President François Mitterrand officiated at the opening of the Channel Tunnel. The 31.5-mile tunnel connects Cheriton, near Folkestone in Kent, with Coquelles, near Calais in France, and is used by Eurostar rail services between London and Paris, Brussels, Amsterdam and other destinations. It also transports cars, coaches and lorries on the Eurotunnel shuttle service. In 2017, the tunnel carried 10.4 million Eurostar passengers, while the shuttle carried 10.3 million car passengers, 2.6 million cars, 51,000 coaches, and 1.6 million lorries. On the 7th of May 1663, the first Theatre Royal Drury Lane was opened. Sadly, it only lasted until 1672 when it burnt down in a fire. The current building is actually the fourth on the site and dates from 1812. It is now owned by Andrew Lloyd Webber and is currently undergoing renovation, and the theatre is due to reopen in May 2021 with a stage version of the Disney animated film Frozen. On the 8th of May 1886, American pharmacist Dr. John Pemberton sold the first glass of Coca-Cola at Jacobs Pharmacy in downtown Atlanta, Georgia. He originally marketed it as Coca-Cola, the temperance drink, after the authorities in Atlanta passed prohibition legislation. Soon afterwards, he billed it as a patent medicine, claiming that it could cure conditions such as morphine addiction, indigestion, nerve disorders, headaches, and impotence. And so we come to the end of this programme. Many thanks to Leslie, Angela, Wendy, and Pat, our readers today, to Angela again for providing the radio listings, and to John who read them, to Mark who makes all the copies of the programme, and to Michelle who ensures you get yours. So that's all from News Extra for April 2021. But as I mentioned at the beginning, for the next two programmes in May and June, because of some commitments I have, I will be producing Red Saturn and Bill will produce News Extra. So once again, very many thanks to Bill for helping me. So, the next time you hear my voice, it will be on May's Red Saturn. And with that, I'll say goodbye.